your source for progressive radio that makes a difference.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Lots of good information on health and healing. Also, I'm going to quote a little bit of an article that's long overdue. It's from Rita Redberg and Rebecca Smith Binman from the New York Times, dated yesterday. Yesterday. It's called, We Are Giving Ourselves Cancer. Really? You mean it took you all those years to figure that out? Well, better late than never. Also, if you want to protect yourself against radiation, a new extract will do that. That's important. And we have new information on what yoga will do if you have cancer and the health benefits of kiwis. There's a lot of them, and we want to make sure that people know what they are. We also are going to show you what melatonin will do to stop cancer. From our environmental segment today, we have a lot to share because many of the things that I have been predicting are now coming true. So we're going to talk about such things as looking at the Great Lakes shrinking and drinking water in 17 California communities is about to run dry. Okay, so they have time. They have 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, right? No, they have 90 days. That's it, 90 days. 3 months, they're out of water. That's in 17 California communities. And that's according to the state. That's the California Department of Public Health. So remember when I was saying that we're now in chaos theory and that one night you go to bed, everything seems all right, and the next day you wake up and the world has changed. Your world, depending upon where you're at and the circumstances of your life, can radically change. Who would have thought that it would have happened that fast? But that's what's going to be happening all the time, all over the world. So that's why I'm putting more emphasis now than ever before on water. Do you remember I also said last week that it's going to be happening all over the Middle East? Well, it's happening in one country and affecting in just one city 20 million people. I'll tell you about that. And a commentary from Tara Lohan from Alternet. Obama's weak environmental agenda is suicide for humanity. Here's the stark ecological future we face. That's directly from her article that will be posted on our website today. I have a guest in the second part of our program to talk about something you may not have heard before. It's called electromagnetic muscle testing, and it's a part of energetics of health and disease. You've heard me say that everything in life is an exchange of energy. Well, now, one doctor, Dr. Mark Mincola, in the Boston area, is using it to determine what a person needs. So it's part of energy medicine, which is also part of Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, Native American medicine. So we'll go into that with him. And I'm going to put out there something that Obama left out of his speech this past week, and that is he didn't talk at all about the human costs for his drone, his kill program. Well, I'm going to share with you from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, Jack Searle, more than 2,400 dead as Obama's drone campaign marks 5 years. I didn't hear him celebrating that or even acknowledging it. We will. Also, if time permits today, I want to do a commentary on why I will not watch the Olympics. I don't care what it is. Not because I don't respect the tremendous effort that those athletes undertake to achieve what they do, but because of how it has been exploited. How much of American athletics has been commodified. This is from The Nation magazine. This is from Samantha Retrosi. Quote, why the Olympics are a lot like the Hunger Games. Well, when I read that title, I felt I got to read this. I read it. I'll share this with you today because she was in the Olympics. She was in the last Winter Olympics, and she was in the women's single luge event. So I'll give you her comments about how we watching this are no different than the people watching the Hunger Games. Seem far-fetched? Well, listen to her commentary, then you decide. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. I remember writing my first major nationally published article on the politics of cancer in 1975. And then I did a whole series. In fact, the series evolved into the politics of cancer, and from that evolved into medical genocide series. And all, I believe I had about 58 cover stories, meaning front cover of a major national magazine with major campaigns, posters on buses, subways. It was a big deal. For about 20 years, I did that. And it was hard to get anyone, almost impossible in the mainstream media, including the New York Times, to acknowledge how much cancer we were causing, especially from mammography, especially from radiation. At the time, one of the people I interviewed extensively was a Dr. Grofman. He was an expert in radiology. I also interviewed a Dr. Steenblok, Ernest Steenblok, who was a professor in radiological sciences down at the University of Pennsylvania, and others in the field who were experts. And they all said the same thing. There is no such thing as safe radiation. Even radium. Remember those radium mines that people go to back in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s because it helped their arthritis and bursitis and asthma and cleared up their skin? Bad idea. Because those later would prove to be fatal because it's still low-level radiation, which is still harmful. And as Dr. John Goffman, probably the greatest scientist in American history on the subject of radiation, he was the discoverer of plutonium, he said that a single X-ray, one single X-ray at any time in your life will ultimately cause cancer later in your life. So I wrote about it, and I put the articles up. None were ever refuted. No facts were ever changed because they stood the test of time. Here is what, finally, the New York Times has to say. And I commend them for it. Quote, despite great strides in preventing and treating cancer, well, you got that wrong, rates remain stubbornly high and may soon surpass heart disease as the leading cause of death in the United States. Got that wrong also. Two fact checks I got to correct the New York Times on. Man, I wonder how much they get paid over there. First, do your homework. The number one cause of death from all causes in the United States is not stroke or heart attack or cancer. It's iatrogenesis, medically induced. And it has been every year for the past 30 years. And also, we have done nothing materially to prevent cancer except for those individuals who have chosen through their education and lifestyle modification to make better and healthier choices. That's what prevent cancer means in the United States. And treatments, we have not evolved a single major treatment modality for any of the major organic cancers, lung, brain, heart, pancreas, esophageal, ovarian cancer, or melanomas. And if you know that such literature, we've had major progress, reduced it, double-blind placebo-controlled studies, show them. Where are they? They don't exist. In any case, that said, let's continue. Increasingly, we and many other experts believe that an important culprit may be our own medical practices. We are silently irradiating ourselves to death. Bingo, you got that right. And good for you. I'm glad that you have stated that. Quote, the use of medical imaging with high-dose radiation, CT scans in particular, has soared in the last 20 years. our resulting exposure to medical radiation has increased more than 600% between the 1980s and 2006, according to the National Council on Radiation Protection and Measurements. The radiation doses of CAT scans, which are a series of X-ray images from multiple angles, are 100 to 1,000 times higher than conventional X-rays. Of course, early diagnosis, thanks to medical imaging, can be life-saving, but there is distressingly little evidence of better health outcomes associated with the current high rates of scans. There is, however, evidence of its harms. The relationship between radiation and the development of cancer is well understood. A single CAT scan exposes a patient to the amount of radiation that epidemiologic evidence shows can be cancer-causing. The risks have been demonstrated directly in two large clinical studies in Britain and Australia. In the British study, children exposed to multiple CAT scans were found to be 300% more likely to develop leukemia and brain cancer. In a 2011 report sponsored by Susan Komen, the Institute of Medicine concluded that radiation from medical imaging and hormone therapy, the use of which has substantially declined in the last decade, were the leading environmental causes of breast cancer, and advised that women reduce their exposure to unnecessary CAT scans. CAT scans, once rare, are now routine. 1 in 10 Americans undergo a CAT scan every year, and many of them get more than one. This growth is a result of multiple factors, including a desire for early diagnosis, higher quality imaging technology, direct-to-consumer advertising, the financial interests of doctors and the imaging centers. CAT scan scanners cost millions of dollars. Having made the investment, purchasers are strongly incentivized to use them. And then it goes on from there. Good article. I commend you for writing it. It's important, but if you go back, you'll find that Bill Falloon, in my opinion, one of the most courageous journalists in American history, has done the definitive article, an investigative reporting article, showing the failure of the CAT scan machines, the errors in their measurements, how many of them are broken, how many of them can't control the output, and how much money is made, and the statistics on them. And he did that 4 years ago. So, but his was in Life Extension, yours is in the New York Times. So I guess history begins today and not for any other reason than we don't recognize anything other than official truths. Black plum leaf extract protects against fatal effects of radiation. So here we just showed you the harm of radiation. Now some good news. This is from Natural News, and it talks about gamma radiation in X-rays. And they're able to travel many meters invisible through space and penetrate human tissue centimeters at a time. This interference can affect cells in negative ways. So in the modern age of medical intervention, it's easy to take professional advice and succumb to routine doses of different radiation. Now there's information on the black plum leaf. Quote, it significantly increases survival rate of mice exposed to radiation. This was a study that was done at the Department of Radiobiology, Kasturba Medical College in Katakantia, India. And the scientists studied the radioprotective effects of black plum extract on mice and found that it made an enormous difference. So one more thing that we should write down, pay attention to, so that if you are getting an X-ray for any reason, at least you have one more thing to use to protect yourself. Yoga is being practiced by more people in America, and that's a good thing, because yoga is very healing, meditative, it's relaxing, it stretches you, reduces fatigue. But there's a new study from Ohio State University, and it shows that yoga reduces fatigue and inflammation in breast cancer survivors. And it says, quote, yoga may help breast cancer survivors beat the debilitating fatigue and sleep problems that often follow toxic treatments such as chemotherapy and radiation. Fatigue can be a big challenge for cancer survivors. Quote, even some years out from breast cancer treatment, anywhere from 30 to 40% of women report substantial levels of fatigue. And then it goes on to talk about how when they were practicing yoga, they had more energy and less fatigue. So that's good. Preeclampsia risk is a big deal. How do you get it? A new study shows vitamin D deficiency. From the University of Pittsburgh, published in the peer-reviewed journal Epidemiology, quote, research led by investigators in the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health suggests that women who have a vitamin D deficiency in the first 26 weeks of pregnancy are more likely to develop severe preeclampsia. Now, for those of you who are not aware what preeclampsia or eclampsia is, it's a potentially life-threatening pregnancy complication that usually occurs after the first 20 weeks of gestation or shortly after birth. And according to the Preeclampsia Foundation, about 8% higher of pregnancies are affected by the condition. So this way, vitamin D could help with that. All right, so that's not, vitamin D is not difficult to take. I remember when the kiwi was a hot new exotic fruit. Not all places had it. A lot of people didn't know what it was, so they didn't buy it. Now it's common. But why should we have this this fruit? It was originally cultivated in northern China, and then it was brought to New Zealand at the turn of the 20th century. Then it was known as the Chinese gooseberry. And today, this small, brown, fuzzy little fruit, I grow it. It's fun to go out and pick. There's nothing better than picking a fruit fresh off the vine. It's loaded with nutrition. It's very rich in vitamin C. An average kiwi has about 65 milligrams of vitamin C, making it a little better than an orange. Has some potassium, lots of potassium, about 250 milligrams. Has some folic acid, which is good. And has fiber. So it's good for you. It's it can help with better sleep, and it also helps with the heart because of its potassium. So, all good in the kiwi, and it helps lower blood pressure. Once again, because it's high in potassium, and that can negate the effects of sodium in the body. So, let's say you had a meal, maybe you just had too much salt in that meal. Have some kiwi. In fact, make yourself a kiwi juice. Take 5 or 6 kiwis, juice them, and drink that down. Boy, that will help bring down your blood pressure. It's delicious. And finally, for those of you who take spirulina, I know many people in this audience take spirulina. If you're taking your green powders, you're getting spirulina and chlorella. Well, here's the latest. And this is really positive. It says, quote from Natural News, copper is a naturally occurring free metal. The body uses this metal for a variety of actions and regulates proper amounts. Too much copper taxes the kidneys and liver and can be detrimental. The right amount is essential. A certain blue-green algae called spirulina has been found to reduce copper toxicity and improve blood and growth. And this modulating action, as seen in this study, this was on fish, effectively eliminates excess copper obtained through overload water, soil, and air. So I think we should have about 2 milligrams of copper in the diet. Some people would get maybe a milligram, 3 milligrams, but nice to know that spirulina is a regulator. That's the latest on health and nutrition from the environment. Now, we have several things to share with you. First up, officials in drought-stricken California on Tuesday announced 17 communities that could run out of water in 100 days or less. The list compiled by the California Department of Public Health comes as a result of Governor Brown's declaration 2 weeks ago of a drought state of emergency. According to the California Department of Public Health, the rural communities on the list range in size up to 11,000, and we're talking about 17 of these. So they're running out of water completely. There won't be a drop. So, and the rest of California, you're right behind them. It's just a matter of time. This is from Tara Lohan from Alternet. I won't read it all, but I'll read some of it because it makes a statement that I think needs to be heard. Quote, are there any self-respecting environmental organizations out there that are still behind President Obama? After his State of the Union speech, it's hard to imagine there could be. In his address, Obama proudly declared, quote, the above energy strategy I announced a few years ago are working, and today America is closer to energy independence than we've been in decades, end quote. Based upon what we know from the most recent climate science, Obama's all-the-above energy policy is actually suicidal. To say that we're approaching a dangerous precipice would be too optimistic and overly simplistic and unrealistic. For a decade, we are peering over the edge, and now we're falling. How long and how hard depends upon what we do this year and in the next few years. The biggest reason for our desperate situation is our failure to address climate change. Obama acknowledges the problem is real, but his approach to energy issues veers from reality. The more science we understand, the worse the picture looks. Ice sheets and glaciers are being depleted and are retreating at faster rates than we first thought. Ocean acidification is on the rise. And the last 30 years were the warmest in the last 1,400 years. Scientists told us we needed to drop emissions of greenhouse gases drastically to avoid raising global temperatures above 2 degrees Celsius. But it's looking like we'll hit that level within 30 years or sooner. Some new research says even this threshold is too high, that we need more aggressive plans for low-carbon economies and quickly. If we continue on our current path set out by Obama and other world leaders, we'll be welcoming the age of catastrophic climate change soon. The effects will look different depending upon where you live, but we know we'll see an increase in the frequency and severity of storms, floods, and droughts, more catastrophic wildfires, sea level rise, and loss of animal and plant species. We're already seeing this. The best way to shift to a low-carbon future is to make it an economic imperative. Clean energy simply has to be cheaper than dirty energy. And in some places, it's happening. Recently in Minnesota, where a solar plant beat out a gas plant based upon economics. Europe is ahead of the game when it comes to wind in countries like Denmark, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, and Germany. Even Texas, the heart of the U.S. oil industry, is about to hit a 10% power from wind. This is great news, but our transition to cleaner energy needs to happen faster and in more places. Leveling the playing field by eliminating subsidies for dirty fossil fuel is a must. Despite or maybe because of climate change's far-reaching impacts on our health, environment, safety, and economy, it's difficult as an issue for some people to connect to. Okay, my take on it is this. Based upon how powerful ALEC and its members are, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Council, the Business Roundtable, the Fortune 500 companies, the economic advisors, virtually every major political appointment in any governmental agency, the control of the media, there's virtually zero chance that there's going to be any meaningful change in our environmental policies, because behind our political policy, there is economic reality. The people who control the body politic also control the economic foundations, the corporations, the think tanks, and the media. So we're not going to have change. They'll talk about it, but they've been talking about it for decades. They'll do nothing about it. Therefore, I believe that virtually all of our energy should go into making ourselves as educated as possible about where we should be living, how we should be living, the quality of our life, and looking to do so are on our own if you choose, or with others, so that you can continue having a quality of life. When I was recently in Colorado, just a few months ago, and I was premiering two new television specials on PBS, which have aired and have been very popular out there, I spoke with a gentleman in the studio who told me that his home was wiped out in the flooding. And when I asked didn't you know that it was possible? He said, yeah, well, we all know it's possible, but you don't think it's going to be you, and besides, you're up on a hill, and it's never happened before, and it had never happened in the past. Well, death doesn't happen in the past and doesn't happen yesterday, but it is going to happen. And but it was like this person had lost everything, but they would they? And I ask, would you rebuild again? He said, yeah. So what's the lesson learned? There is no lesson learned. Conformity to the idea that somehow we just keep doing and living the way we have, and somehow things will be better. They won't. So we have to take the initiative. There's lots of good places to live. There's lots of good jobs. There's lots of good communities. There's lots of good people. We have no shortages of solutions. They're just not in the current major political economic paradigm, and they're not going to be, irrespective of the platitudes you've heard from other people. For those of you living outside the United States, the Middle East in particular, I said that it's going to be happening over there as well. This is the latest from the New York Times, from Thomas Erdbrink. Quote, "Its Great Lake shriveled, Iran confronts crisis of water supply." I'll just read a short amount. Quote, "Lake Urmia, Iran. After driving for 15 minutes over the bottom of what was once Iran's largest lake, a local environmental official stepped out of his truck, pushed his hands deep into his pockets, and silently wandered into the great dry plain as if searching for water he knew he would never find. Just an hour earlier, on a cold winter day here in western Iran, the official had recalled how he recently, just a decade ago, saw cruise ships filled with tourists plied the lake's waters in search of flocks of migrating flamingos. Now the ships are rusting in the mud, and the flamingos fly over the remains of the lake on their way to more hospitable locales. According to figures compiled by the local environmental office, only 5% of the water remains." Mind you, this is Iran's largest lake, largest one in the country, 95% gone. Iran is facing a water shortage, potentially so serious that officials are making contingency plans for rationing in the greater Tehran area, home to 22 million and other major cities around the country. The president of Iran identified water as a national security issue, and in a public speech in areas struck hardest by the shortage of water, he promised, quote, "bring the water back." Yeah, well, that's not happening anywhere in the world. So you're not bringing it back. You're only going to have less of it. So that's there. And then it talks about all the wells that were dug. Now they're drained, all the lakes gone. Their large salt lake, the largest in the world, shriveled up. It was 90 miles long and 35 miles wide. Now, I've been out to Salt Lake in Utah, and that was the largest in the United States. But this one's larger, and now it's shrinking down to nothing. So that's happening all over. In Kenya, there was a lake that 300,000 Kenyans use for the fishing, and hence their food and commerce, and water for living, drinking, washing. And now it's gone. All right? The fish need the deeper water to survive, and they don't have it. So you're seeing water problems everywhere. Now, I dealt with this on my Monday night show that you can download on Peak Water, and that is a real eye-opener. Now for a commentary, and this one today is from The Nation magazine, from Olympian, and Samantha Petrosi. I'll quote it. It's not very long, but I think it's very important that we hear something like this. "As a former Olympic athlete, I can tell you from experience that the Olympic Games have much more in common with the Hunger Games than anyone would want to admit. I connect with the inhumanity of the Hunger Games because I've been there. As a luge competitor at the 2006 Winter Olympics in Turin, Italy, no, I didn't get sucked into the depths of an artificial lake like the character played by Jennifer Lawrence, but I did get sucked into the rafters of an artificially manufactured tube of glare ice, only to come crashing down in the second run of my Olympic moment. The grandeur of the opening ceremonies of the Hunger Games is designed to mask the cruelty of the competition itself. The Olympic opening ceremonies serve a similar purpose, like the kinds that we see where kids representing the districts of Panmia Each nation's athletes are trotted around a massive arena like prize ponies, shrouded in the patriotic glory of their particular flag. The carefully orchestrated pageantry is misleading, telling us that the Olympics are a celebration of the human capacity to achieve, to overcome obstacles, and that the world's best athletes represent something bigger than themselves. But make no mistake, for the global elite, the Olympics are an investment, and one with a rapidly growing price tag. At the London Games, the cost of the opening ceremonies alone was a whopping $42 million. Then, this year, Russia will shell out $51 billion for a two-week event, making these games more expensive than all previous Winter Olympics combined. In the Hunger Games, Jennifer Lawrence is the sacrificial lamb of District 12. As one of the prize ponies of the U.S. team, I served a similar purpose for the Turin Games. Groomed from the tender age of 11, I spent my childhood pursuing Olympic glory, which epitomizes the American dream of merit-based success. Looking back now, I finally understand an experience I couldn't quite grasp as a child. I see that the beautiful illusion I once searched for is a fabrication, the creation of ingenious marketing mechanisms by those who run the Olympic show. I once hoped that the patriotic glory I was told so much about would give meaning to the physical and emotional pain of my athletic struggle. I grew accustomed to gritting my teeth under the strain of various forms of pain, the daily grind of hours of elite-level training, and the toll it exacted on my developing body, the pain I felt upon slamming into a wall of ice at 80 miles an hour, the biting winter cold that whipped across my thinly protected spandex-clad form while sitting atop a frozen winter landscape. Then there was the emotional pain and fear, which took on various forms, the constant fear of bodily harm that scarred my mind, and just as many body was scarred by more than 100 stitches, the fear that I would disappoint those I loved and those who had invested time and money in my athletic career. There was the pain of failure, of hope swallowed by frequent defeat. Then there was the gendered pain that an adolescent female standing in underwear in the glass cube of sports science, each area of fat accumulated clinically pinched by a man with metal tongs. I once hoped that by withstanding all this pain, there'd be one day a payoff, even if only an emotional one. Now I understand my failure to connect to the pomp of the opening ceremonies, the confused emptiness that consumed me as I stood in the cold of a Turin winter, wrapped in the American flag, wincing under the cruel glare of 1,000 flashbulbs. The real function of the Olympic athlete in the world of corporatized sports is clear to me now. Amateur status is mandatory for an Olympic hopeful, but athletic training at the elite level is a full-time job. Most nations get around the problem by giving their Olympic athletes significant government support, but our best athletes are almost always dependent upon corporate sponsorship. For the athletes, the consequences of this addiction can be disastrous. The socialization of my allegiance to Verizon began the moment I was selected as an 11-year-old for the U.S. development team. The culture within the U.S. Luge Association viewed brand loyalty as integral to the survival of the organization. All my clothing was plastered with the Verizon logo. I was not allowed near any camera without giving a visual and verbal statement of thanks to Verizon for making all my dreams come true. I went through intensive media training each year to reinforce this allegiance, to learn how to be a better spokesperson for Verizon. During my Olympic year, I signed away my rights to use any media time for just about anything other than gratitude to sponsors. It was a condition of entrance into the Olympic Village. In the wake of the 2008 recession, Verizon found itself on rocky terrain, so it began breaking many of its sponsorship contracts with amateur sports organizations. One of those was with the U.S. Luge Association, to which it gave millions of dollars a year. USA Luge, which spent decades cultivating this relationship at the expense of all other funding, has been unable to replace it. Today, the Luge athletes have had to look elsewhere for support, with many having little choice but to join the U.S. Army world-class athlete program, not surprisingly given the similarity in value systems, both the armed forces and the elite-level sports program cultivate extreme discipline, patriotism, and victory at all cost. Apparently, one must be willing to enlist and possibly fight and die for one's country in order to cover the expenses of international competition. There's a lot of money to be made in Olympic sports, a huge global media event that rolls around every 2 years. The corporate sponsor bottom lines are merely one indicator of the vast sums involved. To see just who is generating this wealth, one has to look no further than the act of sponsorship itself. With individual athletes and entire teams purchased and traded among the corporate elite like valuable additions to bursting stock portfolios. As an athlete in a sport as insignificant in the United States as luge, I could never hope to see my face plastered on a Wheaties box. However, I wasn't too obscure to escape the eye of masterminds of gender commodification at Maxim. Apparently, spandex uniforms make the women of the U.S. luge hot commodities. Lucky me. For sponsors, the way to cash in is clear. Athletes are put up for sale in a variety of ways. Olympic event coverage, elaborate marketing devices and product placement, branding rights, and exclusive access to the use of athlete images and identities are used not only in the sale of media products, but in the gamut of other commodities attached to the Olympic brand during the course of an Olympic year. The Olympic rings themselves have been copyrighted, reserved exclusively for use by corporate sponsors. As those who generate super profits for sponsors, today's Olympic athletes are workers. Like any other workers, athletes are limited by their economic vulnerability, in this case, controlled by the sporting hierarchy. Ironclad corporate control enforces social discipline over the athletes themselves, but also over the economy of the Olympics as a whole. Corporate domination of the Olympic economy is supreme. Yet, as any good capitalist knows, the best way to ensure the continuation of top-down control is successful psychological manipulation. All too often, athletes' perspectives on the nature of their social position are shaped by the same PR campaigns that further the exploitation of their labor. To sponsors, athlete value is about how much money can be made off an individual, not just in the act of competition, but more importantly, in victory. It's no surprise that the indicators of athletic success are also those that drive market success, and that both are products of the same ideology: competition, individualism, domination. When these values are combined with the athlete's tenuous economic identity as an exploited labor pool, the competition for resources cements a divide-and-conquer relationship that undermines their ability to think and act in terms of solidarity with their fellow athlete workers. Throw in a teaspoon of patriotism and a dash of nationalism, and the recipe for divide and conquer is complete. The result is a subservient class that plays by the rules of the corporate sponsors and the sporting managerial class. And that's how it is. And that is something that, as a competitive athlete, still competing, just won a major state championship just 5 weeks ago, competing next week in a national 20K championship, I've seen all this. Because in the World Games, you frequently see former Olympians and you hear their stories. Where for a whole week, sometimes two, in a foreign city, so you socialize and you talk about your background. I've spoken with so many Olympians. When they couldn't get the gold, nobody wanted someone to talk about winning the silver and what that does. That's why I boycott the Olympics. I won't watch them. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us today, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Now, before we go to our guest in a few moments, Dr. Mark Mincola, who's up in Boston, who's a holistic healthcare practitioner using electromagnetic muscle testing, and we'll talk about that with him for the remainder of the show. I just want to take a moment, only once, maybe every 2 weeks, I take just a few moments to raise a few dollars, all of which goes to the station to run its expenses, and we try to give you something that really is important. And here's today's offer. Suprema C. Many consider it the finest vitamin C because it's a highly absorbable, buffered form of vitamin C. And it contains the bioflavonoids for enhanced utilization, major antioxidants, because we know what vitamin C does. And it comes from highly absorbable ascorbated minerals, strawberry flavor, and that's our Suprema C. It's a powder. It's 24 ounces. Lasts you a long time. So that's what you're getting with vitamin C. And you're getting 625 milligrams per serving, which is just a quarter of a teaspoon per serving, by the way. And you're also getting magnesium ascorbate, manganese ascorbate, potassium ascorbate, zinc ascorbate. You're getting all these wonderful other nutrients in there. All right, that's your vitamin C. But I had never seen this before, and I just got this just now. I'm out on the road. I'll be filming all day in Berkeley, then L.A., then Montreal, then Quebec, all for the next 4 weeks that I'm back in New York, because I'm finishing up this major important work on poverty called Poverty Inc., which will be our big documentary for the year. We'll be premiering it in August, and we're working on it every day in New York. Our producers are and our editors, but I'm out on the road doing the final filming. So I've never seen this before. Here's your free gift today. So you're going to get Suprema C at a big discount. You're going to save $60 on this. And here's what you're getting. You're getting this book, Living in the Moment, free. I think it's a $25 book. Here are the testimonials, and I've never seen these before. I'm going to quote them. I was truly astonished as I began reading Living in the Moment by Gary Noll. Rather than being another self-help book with good advice, this book took me on a journey right to the center of my life. It spoke to me so vividly, I recognized so much of my own struggles in it, that I could not put it down. This unique piece of work not only offers a profound and yet simple blueprint to reclaim our lives and ourselves from the people, beliefs, and conditioned behaviors we have been caught in, but it provides many wonderful tools to show us how. There are many specific questions, guidelines, and exercises offered which help us let go of what that which has been worn out, remove the veils from our eyes, become authentic, and allow ourselves to know what our lives are truly about. I particularly enjoyed this section where Gary focuses upon the difference between experiences and life lessons. As he wisely says, so many of us confuse the two and try again on our own identity and life purpose through various experiences and various individuals rather than by bravely knowing and encountering the life lessons these experiences point to. All the solutions Gary points to are bold. He seeks out that which we need to learn. We confront that which keeps us off balance and sad. We take strong action to make changes that need to be made. The book is for those who have the courage and the desire to live life to the full. It is for those who have become worn down and burned out by lifeless, repetitive behavior, beliefs, and relationship. As we clean out our emotional and spiritual closets, as we surrender that which is no longer viable, we make room to be replenished and uplifted by the wonderful abundance and energy of the universe. I recommend this book highly to all who seek to clear the way the weeds in their lives and open to the vast possibilities which are them. Dr. Brenda Shoshona, and she is a famous author, and anyhow, there's all these other people, the editor-in-chief, Canadian editor-in-chief of Reader's Digest, give a great quote, and Yoga Magazine, a great quote, Professor Meg Jordan, Department Chairman of the California Integral Studies, quote, once I picked up Gary Noll's latest book, Living in the Moment, I couldn't put it down. His sage advice, called from a lifetime investigating and teaching nutrition, health, and well-being, is inspiring and provocative. We often get stuck in our ruts. We don't even realize how our negative patterns may be holding us back. But in Living in the Moment, Dr. Noll writes us the most important prescription we could ever fill in our lives, how to take responsibility for our own health, body, mind, and soul. And anyhow, there's 3 pages of quotes from some heavy hitters out there. So I didn't know this, never read any of them. I don't look at that stuff, but I thank them. So that you're getting is my gift today. Give a call for this special on your Suprema C. All the money goes to support the Progressive Radio Network. That number is 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. The Supremacy on sale, plus the book that many are saying is one of the most important books I've ever read. And you just heard one of the quotes from Professor Shoshana. She teaches Buddhism also. Let's say hello to my guest standing by, Dr. Mark Mencola. Nice to have you with us.
Gary, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And Mark is the author of Whole Health, A Holistic Approach to Healing for the 21st Century. His website is markmencola, MINCOLLA.com. Mark, one of the fundamental differences between many modalities of alternative or natural medical practice and that of conventional drugs and surgery-based medicine is that the former understands disease more in terms of energy and the principles of physics, whereas the latter emphasize the biochemical dimension. But even when we consider all biomolecular processes, underlying them all is the deeper strata of energy and quantum properties. So when conventional medicine says it speaks with a chemical imbalance as the causative factors of disease, holistic theory would say that underlying the chemical actions are deeper and more fundamental energy imbalances. So before speaking about specific therapies, begin by speaking about the differences in diagnosing and treating illness strictly from a biochemical perspective and from an energetic vantage point, and then share a little how traditional views of medicine, such as the Chinese system and what we are now learning about nutritional science, the pros and cons of certain foods, is more in synergy with what we know about physical reality based upon quantum science than is our dominant conventional medical theories.
Gary, beautifully summarized. First, I'd say that we need to remind ourselves that everything is energy. You know, nearly 100 years ago, we awarded Einstein a Nobel Prize for teaching the world that energy and matter are interconvertible and transferable. Energy creates matter, so says Einstein. Therefore, people, you know, you and I, food, thoughts, all are created by and generate energy. Now, to most people, that's a revolutionizing thought that they've yet to come to grasp and wrap their head around, but we have to catch up to the reality that mechanistic chemistry is simply inadequate for fully understanding the phenomena of energy. And as you beautifully pointed out, Oriental medicine, Eastern medicine, Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine are based on this idea that energy and matter are sort of one and the same. You know, it's more a matter of integrating the two concepts, that you have a half a property right now in this country in terms of the traditional form of orthodox diagnostics. It's a half a property in that you don't really fully take into consideration the deeper energies that move from within us that actually generate the life force within our precious cells and organ systems. So I think that we are starting to realize that we have a human biofield. It produces 0.025 volts of an ambient electromagnetic charge at 10 hertz in the form of a direct current. Of course, we do know that we use EEGs and EKGs and MRIs, that everything generates the field. It's all based on field response. And all energy fields have a unique signature. People, animals, foods, thoughts. There's a unique energy signature with all the above. So whenever a biofield signature is interposed with another, it will either produce an entrained or a disentrained response. It will either jive or not jive. For example, if I'm allergic to wheat and someone simply basically holds a box of wheat cereal in front of me toward my heart, close to my body, within the context of my field, and I raise up my left arm to see if I can be muscle tested strong or weak, I'm going to show a weak response if I'm allergic. So most people are used to thinking in terms of cellular responses as to allergies. And my contention over the past 32 years and the 60,000 appointments that I've conducted indicate that indeed we can actually hold, we use vials, we use homeopathic vials, which produce a very active field. They've been succussed very actively to produce a very active electromagnetic field of what once was tomatoes and wheat and dairy and eggs, etc. So we use homeopathic vials, but folks can actually go to the store with loved ones and they can interface and muscle test each other by simply holding the foods close to their field. Or we also show people that you can actually make a similar difference and get a similar responsiveness by calling the word out. We always say that you can call out the word wheat, and you can test your muscle strength to see how your body and your energy field and your biofield respond to the calling out of that particular stimuli. And obviously things like dairy, eggs, wheat, soy, peanuts, tree nuts, shellfish are among the primary allergens that folks are contending with on an ongoing basis. So we feel it's extremely important to use these kind of techniques to try to tap into the preventive measures of how they can avoid allergenic foods.
Good. That's a big beginning, but let's take it now a little further, if you would please, Mark. All of us have our individualized coding, as it were. We're all unique energies, and none of us share identical genetic codes, for example. We are all different. Traditional medicine has known this for centuries, unlike conventional doctors that are taught that all humans seem to come off the same factory line. Traditional systems hone in on the individual health propensities. So speak a little about this individual coding we each have and why it's important for us to learn about it so we can best customize our lives accordingly.
Well, indeed, that is correct. And I think that it's a matter of realizing that at the cellular level, well, people often ask me about specific diets. How do I feel about the blood type diet? And I said it's a wonderful diet in that it attempts to find the individual needs of a person through blood type. However, blood, unlike energy, is more predominantly a material property when you're evaluating nutritional problems and evaluating health care through blood. Blood doesn't really change per se at the material level, but energies are shifting and changing all the time. I ask people how their emotions were a week ago, how their emotions were a month ago or a year ago, how their thoughts are today versus yesterday. So the subtler kind of concepts of thought energy, emotional energy, are more indicative of constant changing. And the energy is, of course, in the state of constant flux. So to be able to test at the energetic level and to be able to use energy as a medium or a diagnostic medium, if you have any kind of artistic access, as the Chinese did, as the Ayurvedics did, and as I attempt to do with my system and whole health, then it enables us a greater flexibility to tap into not only our unique signatures, because as you point out energetically, we really are very, very different. I always tell people when you think about identical twins, they could look identical materially and cellularly, but in terms of, as you point out, genetics, energy, their favorite ball teams and the things they prefer and their foods, et cetera, the energetic properties are going to be so uniquely different from person to person. So we do indeed at the energy level have unique signatures, and they're ever-changing and ever in the state of flux. So I think there's a beautiful connection that we make with the ancient systems of energy diagnostics like Chinese medicine, for example, that enable us this great flexibility and this great ability to tap into not only the signature and the uniqueness of each person at a very refined level, but at the same time we also can keep up with the constant flux and energetic changes as well.
Mark, explain the underlying principles of electromagnetic muscle testing and how it can be an easier way to determine imbalances in our body, and then how we can determine whether certain foods are beneficial or adverse, particularly in identifying serious food allergens. And just as an aside, in 1993, a gentleman showed up one day at the Tri-State Healing Center down on 72nd Street. And he was an Italian scientist, an MD, PhD, and he had seen my work. And he said, I understand you're interested in trying to go further with proving energies, and you were limited by the equipment you were using from Drexel University. And I said, that's correct. He said, well, I've invented something that can take it further. So what he did during that day and during the evening, I was so fascinated by this, he could measure how much of a vitamin C drip the patient needed, how much vitamin A, how much vitamin C, based upon the energy that he was getting back through these measurements. And what was interesting, he didn't know how much any of the patients were getting and the disease they had. So we asked him to test the people, then he gave us the readings, then I had the doctor measure that against the chart. And almost all of them were within 2% of what they were receiving. He would have had no way of knowing that. So there was just another system of someone being able to listen to the body and understand the code that the body has, that it will tell you what it needs. This is part of kinesiology. Ask the body the right question, and it will give you the answer that you need to know because the body's answering it. Your thoughts, please.
Spoken. And I also point to the great work of Dr. Richard Davidson, the neuroplasticity researcher at the University of Wisconsin, who has established very clearly that there is a neurolinguistic quality to the immune system as well. So that by simply calling out words, I mean, I did this on Dr. Oz yesterday, actually, where we called out words that were negative, you know, words like cancer and disease and unhappiness and unhealthiness. And whenever you speak such negative words in dialogue, they have a power, a neurological value, a neurolinguistic value that affect the nervous system, which affects the muscles and immunity, et cetera. So we know that when people are in the constant state of negative dialogue, those negative words actually have a negative effect on the immune system through the nervous system. And as Dr. Davidson often says, his mantra is, our words produce a matching chemistry, neurologically speaking. That is an absolute fact. It's a given fact. So I always say, look, your body has a field of awareness. It's a field of consciousness. As we said, we produce 0.025 volts of an ambient electromagnetic charge at 10 hertz in the form of a direct current that literally is altered by a variety of different influences, like your words, for example, like what you eat, like the company you keep, like the places you go, the things you do. Everything virtually has an energetic reflection and influence. People we surround ourselves with, foods we eat, thoughts, etc. So I bring up the point that in our electromagnetic muscle testing system, it's kind of like your experience with that gentleman that you just mentioned, the Italian gentleman. What we do with our work is we basically have this detailed system that teaches people, and that's really what Whole Health is all about, explaining to the reader that you have this ability to invoke a response through the electromagnetics of words alone. So if I have Gary raise up his left arm and actually give me a good deltoid resistance at shoulder's height, and I tug on his wrist with a gentle tug, and I say, Gary, I'm going to call out the following words, dairy, eggs, wheat, soy, peanuts, tree nuts, shellfish, etc. Each one of these is going to actually have an energetic effect because words have that effect. It's not like we don't know that there's a natural neurolinguistic response. We know that scientifically. The real golden question is, can we trust it? And I've been trusting it for 32 years and 60,000 appointments and have been stunned and shocked and really have written this book to be able to share the reality and the validity of this possibility with people that they have this innate capability to tap into the their bioenergetic fields to get responses in terms of determining food intolerances at the subtle energetic level and even Gary details. In other words, let's say you passed a food like broccoli. I could even ask your nervous system through your muscles whether you can tolerate 1 ounce, 2 ounce, 3 ounces, 4 ounces, 5 ounces, or 6 ounces. At whatever level that you're saturated, your arm is going to go down because you have, as I always point out, a neurological opinion about everything that happens in your life. All stimuli is evaluated neurophysiologically, and you have an answer for everything. It's part of our natural defense system. It's part of our fight or flight system. We're designed that way. We have answers for virtually everything, amounts, qualities, quantities, frequencies, doses, durations, all the above. And that's exactly what we do in the book.
Thank you very much, Mark Mencola, for coming on and sharing this. The book is called Whole Health. The website is Mark Mencola, MINCOLLA.com. All the best to you, Mark.
Thank you, Gary, and to you as well.
We'll be doing more on energy healing from around the world, showing you Ayurvedic medicine from India and African medicine and Chinese medicine. We have a whole series coming. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about a case that raises serious questions about how and why a small software development company that had solved a major problem, the FBI, with a huge budget and 3 years couldn't solve, found itself raided by 21 FBI agents, software and computer equipment and other files confiscated, all six of its executives inexplicably hit with fraud charges and prosecuted in a highly unusual trial, and all six now serving 7 to 10 years in federal prison.
Wow. Well, this is going to be an interesting hour. Utrice Lead, right?
Yes.
Now.
Thank you.